is you know, dropping an ocean is a cliche, but it is it's less than a drop in the ocean. I mean, my friend who wrote to me, her brother-in-law is in a wheelchair, half paralyzed. They couldn't leave because they said, how can we leave the house with him? And we cannot leave him behind. And her mother is old. So they are there. I cannot even imagine what they have been through. She just sent me a flower this morning. They had a little shred of internet, so she sent me a flower responding to my WhatsApp some hours earlier. I have friends cramped in a school in Nusayrat refugee camp, and a mother, a refugee of 48.
You are tuned in to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming on the web at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Finance Committee meets on the third Thursday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found at our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Could I get two of those zucchini, please?
Sure. Anything else for you today?
What is that over in the basket?
Oh, honey, that is the organic, homegrown More Talk Radio with Cecile Prescott and Celeste Carey.
Wow, I'll take one.
It is so great. Every Monday at 8 in the morning.
How do I get more?
Well, you can support programs like this with donations by going to kboo.fm/give or texting KBOO to 44321. It is the Fresh Off the Vine Fall Fun Drive, so it's a great time to give.
More Talk Radio sounds nutritious. I can't wait to try it.
Oh, honey, you're gonna love it.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this fall membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. Protests in America and in Oregon over the war between Hamas and Israel. Why Latinx voters in the West will be critical in the upcoming presidential election. And the author of a new book on MLK Jr. pays Portland a visit.
I've been really warmed by the fact that people seem to love King more when they see him in full picture with flaws and all, that his greatness is more pronounced.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, October 19th, 2023. KBOO is currently in our fall membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. Members of a group called Jewish Voice for Peace Portland called an emergency rally to, quote, stop the genocide now this afternoon outside the offices of Congressman Earl Blumenauer and Oregon U.S. Senator Ron Wyden in Portland. The group's demanding an immediate ceasefire and access to humanitarian aid for the people of Gaza. They want Congress to push for a de-escalation and ceasefire. And another group was in the nation's capital with a similar protest message yesterday, demanding a ceasefire. Meantime, officials say they reached an agreement between Egypt and the United Nations to lay the groundwork for aid into Gaza. The U.S. says the death toll from the Gaza hospital explosion could be as many as 300 people, and Israelis are praising President Biden's visit. The Multnomah County District Attorney's been selected for a pilot program to help survivors of gender-based violence. The DA's office will partner with domestic violence shelter and nonprofit Bradley Engel to provide services for alternatives to prosecution for criminalized survivors. Research shows the needs and experiences of women of color, especially Black women who survive domestic violence, sexual assault, and human trafficking, often go unaddressed in the traditional criminal justice system. DA Mike Schmidt says those survivors experience trauma and exploitation, and that this new grant program will give his office extra tools to help them. Idaho is receiving a failing grade for its process for drawing voting district lines, Eric Tegedov reports.
Idaho received a poor grade in a recent report analyzing redistricting in the state, but it has made the process fairer than many other states. The nonpartisan elections watchdog Common Cause gives Idaho a grade of D for its process of redrawing voting district lines, which happens when states receive census data and use it to map the borders of legislative districts. Eleanor Cheehy with the League of Women Voters of Idaho notes one positive feature of redistricting in the state is its use of an independent commission.
It isn't a situation like some legislators where the majority could just bulldoze the minority or racial groups or whatever.
The report says Native American tribes expressed disappointment with the commission's lack of response to keeping their communities whole in the final maps. It also says the state could have done a better job, including the public. Dan Vicuña is the director of redistricting and representation for Common Cause. He says in past decades, redistricting was a relatively unknown and unscrutinized process. However, Vicuña believes the public is increasingly connecting the shape of voting maps to their fight for resources.
The public understands that whether you're kept in one district with a community that shares concerns of all sorts can really make the difference between having a champion in the halls of power or not having a champion.
Vicuña says the states that fared best in the report are the ones that took redistricting out of the hands of legislators in favor of independent, bipartisan commissions. California and Massachusetts scored the highest grades, A-. I'm Eric Tegedov.
2 million Americans, especially Black, Indigenous, and communities of color and low-income people, are estimated to be living without clean water and sanitation services. As Roz Brown reports, today marks the 9th annual Imagine a Day Without Water.
Most of us take for granted clean, fresh water when we turn on the kitchen faucet. But it can be rare for many people, and it's why the 9th annual Imagine a Day Without Water is being observed today in communities across the U.S. Value of Water campaign director Christy Harowski notes that dozens of communities across the country have suffered devastating impacts to their water systems due to floods, droughts, ice storms, or the result of aging infrastructure.
People do have the belief that our water systems here in the United States are fine, and that is why we take it for granted. But the reality is that the state of water in our country is fragile.
A Day Without Water calls attention to what would happen if taps turned off and folks were not able to prepare meals, bathe their children, or wash clothes. Harowski encourages people to engage in a conversation about water today on social media through the hashtag #ValueWater and get involved locally to make sure their water is safe and protected. Harowski says 2 million Americans, especially Black, Indigenous, and communities of color, as well as low-income communities, are estimated to live without clean water and sanitation services.
Providing water is not free. It takes people and it takes working infrastructure to deliver it equitably across the country and to your tap.
Last month, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency announced $7.5 billion is available through the Water Infrastructure Finance and Innovation Act. The low-interest loan program is meant to help communities invest in drinking water, wastewater, and stormwater infrastructure. This is Ross Brown.
An author of a new book about Martin Luther King Jr. brings a message to Portland. Jonathan Eig was the highlighted speaker for the Hatfield series at the Oregon Historical Society. I caught up with him to talk about his book entitled King, A Life. Hello, Mr. Eig.
Yes, hi. Call me John.
Hi, Jonathan, or John. John, okay. Yeah. John is fine. How are you doing?
Thanks. I'm good. How are you?
When did you get into Portland?
I got in yesterday around noon and just been hanging out, exploring, seeing some friends. So it's been very nice. I had a little extra day between sister.
Have you ever been to our neck of the woods before, or is this your first time?
Yeah, a couple times, but not much. I haven't spent a lot of time out here.
Okay. Where are you? Where do you hail from?
I live in Chicago.
Okay. All right, great. Well, welcome.
Yeah.
You know, I have been reading your book, and it's amazing. It's what I think is amazing about it is that it just reveals this kind of transformative figure as just a man, a person, a human being.
Yeah.
With, thanks, you know, warts and all, right?
Yeah, that was really my first instinct, is that we needed a book that made him more human, because we've, you know, in the past 60 years or so, really done a great service by honoring him, but at the same time, we've stripped him of a lot of his humanity.
Now, this is not your first biography. You've been noted for your work in this sector as writing biographies. What is that process like in terms of, you know, uncovering information that hasn't been revealed before?
Well, it's daunting, and but it's also thrilling. You know, it's daunting to take anyone else's life story in your hands and act as if you have the ability, the right to tell a whole life, because it's unknowable. But you do the best you can, and the thrilling part is when you learn new things, or when you know take someone as familiar as Martin Luther King, and you discover that there's still a lot that we didn't know. You know, in the case of Muhammad Ali, I found out things that Muhammad Ali didn't know about himself. You know, I learned where his parents were married. I learned that his grandfather was a convicted murderer. He didn't even know that himself. So it's like, you know, it's incredibly exciting when you do find new things.
What was the most surprising thing that you found out about MLK?
Well, I think I was surprised, and this is not like shocking to people who knew him, but I was surprised at just how much he suffered emotionally, how difficult the journey was for him, how sad his life was at times, and just how, you know, we all know he was under FBI scrutiny, but we don't think about how that affected him and how he had to live with that day to day. And that was just really mind-boggling to me. That just really helped me to understand that, it's, you know, it was personal, and that he experienced it personally, even though it was history with a capital H, it was still very personal.
Uh-huh. What was interesting, part of what was interesting to me, was how he actually came from a, I guess by the standards of that time, a pretty affluent African-American family that hadn't gone through a lot of the really arduous struggles of his ancestors.
Right. I was interested in that too. And it was, you know, a lot of his friends and colleagues all said that, you know, he didn't have quite as many bruises as a lot of other Black people of his era had, in part because he grew up protected by his parents and in this nurturing environment on Auburn Avenue in Atlanta. And that's really part of what made him special. It gave him the confidence to think that he could go out and do things that maybe other people considered impossible.
Mm-hmm. One of the stories that really stuck out to me was the one about, I think it was his great-grandmother or grandmother, who her son, she sent him out for an errand, and he was told by a white man to go get some water for some workers, and he refused, saying he was doing an errand for his mom, and he was beaten badly, and the mother turned around and went and beat the man who beat him at considerable peril to herself. So that, to me, indicated ancestors who displayed a lot of courage in the face of really awful injustice.
No question about it. And the reason I was so taken by Delia's story is that a lot of people were destroyed by that anger, by that suffering. And King's grandfather, Jim King, was beaten by it. He ended up turning to alcohol and became a violent man. But Delia never lost faith in God. So she fought back and got away with it, but still considered herself Christian and somebody who believed in love. And, you know, that kind of, I think that in some ways made her the, you know, the real, you know, King's important ancestor, that, you know, he inherited a lot from her.
Mm-hmm. And this whole idea about peaceful protest and then leading to what we experienced here in the city of Portland with the Black Lives Matter protests that went on for months and months and months. It's obvious that these issues are still bringing us into the present moment. This is not just part of our history. It is going on now.
That's a big part of why I wanted to write this book, is that the parallels between the racial struggle in the 60s and today are just unavoidable and sad, because so much of what King was fighting for continues to be a problem. I mean, so much of what he was fighting against continues to be a problem, I should say. You know, he was fighting against police brutality. He was fighting against economic inequality. He was fighting against systemic racism. He was fighting against people who believed that the Bible said that Black people were inferior and that white people were superior. And we're still grappling with a lot of these same arguments.
Yeah. And I even look at what's going on over in the Middle East right now with the Israelis and the Palestinians, mm-hmm. the othering of another group of people, whether it's over religion or race or what have you. It just seems like these issues are so salient right now.
Yeah. King warned us about the fact that militarism damaged our souls and that it changed us as people, and that we're seeing the effects of that in this time. And also King talked about the fact that we were all God's children made in the same image, and that these national and racial distinctions were entirely man-made, and that they were made often so that one person could feel superior to another. And we're certainly seeing that in the Middle East and in Ukraine and, you know, on the streets of America.
Yeah, that's amazing. So tell me a bit about your speech that you're going to be giving for the Hatfield Lecture.
I'm really excited. You know, as I've been on the tour for this book, I've almost always been in conversation on stage with another person, and I haven't given a whole lot of speeches where I'm standing up there by myself talking for 30, 40 minutes. And in this case, you know, we're doing, a hybrid where I'm speaking alone and then engaging in conversation after that and taking questions. But, you know, I'm really excited because as I've been out touring with this book and hearing how the book resonates with people, I think I've begun to understand King and understand my own book in new ways. Because it's one thing to sit in your office and write a book, and I had a lot of people helping me, and I shared the book with a lot of people. But when you get out and you start talking about King and you see how much he still matters to people, you see how much people still yearn for a moral leader who puts himself second, who puts society first. It's been really moving. So I hope that I can capture some of that spirit. I certainly can't even try to match King as an orator, but I hope that, you know, telling his story, you know, moves people the way that his story moves me.
Yeah. Is this going to be your biggest audience that you've had for this book?
I think so. I didn't ask them how many tickets they've sold. I was trying not to think about it because I don't want to get nervous. but I spoke to about 1,500 students at Morehouse 2 weeks ago, and that was my biggest audience to date. And it was a tough audience, you know, because I have a 20-year-old daughter, and I know how hard it is to capture the attention of kids that age. And they're Morehouse men, so they feel, you know, a great sense of connection to King. So I was super nervous about that. So I figured this audience can't be that tough.
Has there been pushback? Speaking of being tough, has there been pushback from some people saying that, you know, you're not presenting him as necessarily this perfect heroic figure, that he had flaws, that he made mistakes, that he mistreated people in some parts of his life? Is that a message that people are bristling against at all, or not?
No. I've been really kind of pleasantly surprised that, you know, there have been a few people who said, hey, why do you have to criticize Dr. King? And I said, I don't think I criticized him. And the vast majority of people who've read the book and who've come out to hear me speak told me that they feel like they love him more for his flaws, that they can understand him, they can relate to him better. And it's hard to read about him, you know, cheating on his wife, and it's hard to read about him neglecting women who might have made great contributions to the movement, and, you know, lots and other things. But overall, I think I've been really warmed by the fact that people seem to love King more when they see him in full picture with flaws and all, that his greatness is more pronounced.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the one thing I would say I grappled with the most, is my feelings about his view of women and how he saw women as essentially second-class citizens who were there to protect the kids and raise the kids, and had a very traditional view of what home life was supposed to be and who was responsible for the children and the family. So,
yeah, I grappled with that too. And, you know, it's one thing to write it off and to say he was a product of his time and he was raised in the Baptist church and all that, but he's one of our great fighters for equality, and you'd expect him to come around and to do better over time, but he never really made much progress on that issue. Maybe if he'd lived longer and had a chance to see his daughters grow up, he would have evolved. I don't know.
Yeah, and the idea of Coretta as his life partner, and the fact that she was intelligent and she was talented, but kind of had to be subservient to him. And,
yeah,
you know, that was really, really fascinating to see how she must have grappled with that. That must have been tough for her to, you know, give up her music career.
Yeah, no question about it. And she says over and over in these interviews and letters that she wrote, you know, and this too, I accepted. And this too, I accepted. She says it so many times, you can just feel her pain, because she was a brilliant, energetic, incredibly motivated activist, and she could have been, you know, much more involved and much more helpful if she'd been given the chance.
Yeah, that's so fascinating. And that probably had to do with, like you said, the church and his father, his own father's relationship that he saw growing up with his,
yeah,
with his mom.
No doubt.
So I kind of saw him as a figure. He kept demanding people be peaceful in their protest, yet he was often not at peace even with himself. Is that fair to say?
Right. Yeah, that is fair to say. You know, he embraced the concept of peace, certainly, and loving one another, but that doesn't mean it's easy. And, you know, he talked about that a lot, that, you know, nonviolence doesn't mean weakness. It takes real strength to be nonviolent. You know, of course, with his own life, he struggled with complex emotions of anger, frustration, even depression. So, you know, doesn't not easy for any of us to, you know, grapple with the complexity of life.
That's Jonathan Eig, the author of King, A Life. You're listening to a fall membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News. Our goal is to raise $55,000 by the end of October. I'd like to remind you that you can renew your KBOO membership or become a member at any time during this program by going online to kboo.fm/give. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News In Depth. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, American Indian Airwaves. Tonight's weather, clear skies this evening, give way to low clouds and fog after midnight, a low of 56. Tomorrow's weather, foggy early, partly cloudy later in the day, a high of 72. Today in history, on this date in 1985, the first Blockbuster video rental store opened in Dallas, Texas. It went through a boom, but by 2014, the last of the company-owned stores closed. An independently owned Blockbuster in Bend, Oregon is the only store still open. The quote of the day is from Reed Hastings. Comparing Apple to Netflix is like comparing apples to oranges, especially if the oranges made so many mistakes that people stopped eating oranges and just went back to Blockbuster. President Biden promises an unprecedented aid package for Israel. Congressman Jim Jordan loses ground in his bid for House Speaker, saying he would temporarily suspend his bid, then changing course, saying he'll pursue a third vote for Speaker. And Republican presidential hopefuls cite violence in the Middle East as a reason to seal the U.S.-Mexico border. With more in the stories impacting our democracy, here's today's edition of 2023 Talks.
Arab, Jew, Muslim, Christian, everyone, you can't give up what makes you who you are.
President Joe Biden warns Israelis not to be consumed by rage following the deadly Hamas attacks. Speaking in Tel Aviv, the president said the U.S. was enraged by 9/11 but made mistakes seeking revenge. Biden announced Israel will allow humanitarian aid to enter Gaza from Egypt. He also said the other team was likely responsible for a Gaza hospital blast that killed hundreds, sparked mass protests, and forced him to cancel a summit in Jordan. Fighting increased along Israel's northern border with Lebanon, and the U.S. military said it thwarted an attack on American forces in Iraq. Biden's nominee for ambassador to Israel, former Treasury Secretary Jacob Lew, told senators he'd ensure Israel has what it needs to defend itself.
There is no greater mission than to be asked to strengthen the ties between the United States and Israel, to work toward peace in a region that has known so much war and destruction.
Several Republicans are voicing concern over Lew's role in helping to shape the lapsed Iran nuclear agreement. Peace protesters, including American Jews, shouting "not in our name," disrupted Lew's hearing 3 times before being removed. Capitol Police separately arrested other protesters who were demanding a ceasefire. Hard right Congressman Jim Jordan of Ohio failed to win the House speakership for a second time, in fact, losing the vote by a larger margin. He says he remains determined since most alternatives would need Democratic support.
No one in our conference wants to see any type of coalition government with Democrats. So we're going to keep working and we're going to get to the votes.
Some Republicans say interim Speaker Patrick McHenry of North Carolina should temporarily be able to bring bills to the floor. That's so the House can move forward on aid for Israel and deal with a potential government shutdown next month. Some Republican presidential hopefuls are using the Israeli-Palestinian conflict to call for tighter security at the U.S.-Mexico border. Former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley says the U.S. shouldn't wait for another 9/11.
I have been terribly worried about the fact that Iran has said the easiest way to get into America is through the southern border. We have an open border.
Florida Governor Ron DeSantis says too many military-age men are entering the U.S.
Israel probably has the strongest border security in the world, and yet this happened to them.
Former President Donald Trump says without evidence that Hamas militants are pouring over the border. A social media influencer just got 7 months in prison for spreading lies aimed at suppressing Democratic turnout in 2016. Prosecutors say Douglas Mackey, who posted under the alias Ricky Vaughn, tried to use disinformation to prevent people of color and women from voting. I'm Catherine Carley for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
About 36% of Latinx voters in one Western state say the issue of immigration has a lot of influence on their decision for which candidate to support in the presidential race. Now a professor is calling for a fact check of the legal system, as Alex Gonzalez explains.
Law school professor and co-dean emeritus at Rutgers University, David Lopez, says Arizona State University has evolved since he was an undergraduate student there back in the 80s. Today, Lopez says he's proud to see the university be a Hispanic-serving institution, as more than 25% of the student body is Hispanic. Lopez is back temporarily in his home state of Arizona and alma mater as a distinguished visiting professor to teach about legal structures and cases through the lens of the Latino community by using a music and humanities approach to what he calls fact-checking the law. Lopez says he wants to foster allyship and empathy among students of all backgrounds. Out of the nearly 300 Juris Doctor law students in 2022, 35% were students of color.
Coming from Arizona, you understand the history and the reality of a racialized border and how that sort of bleeds out into communities, regardless of immigration status. All you have to do is look at the really sweeping findings of racial profiling.
Lopez says controversial legislation such as Senate Bill 1070, which required law enforcement officers to inquire about a suspect's status if they had reason to believe the individual was in the U.S. illegally, incited fear across Arizona. While the effects are still felt today, he's found it's given rise to activism, which over the years has cultivated a stronger sense of belonging for the Latino community. A recent survey commissioned by the Immigration Hub found a majority of Latino voters in key 2024 states, such as Arizona, want President Joe Biden to provide more relief to migrants in the U.S. without legal status, while also securing the southern border. Lopez argues the legal system is structured in such a way that it leaves the multifaceted Latino community in what he calls a state of displacement and limbo.
Maricopa County has been ground zero of so much in terms of national division over immigration and, you know, ASU sitting right here in the middle of ground zero. And I think there was sort of the sense that it's important to engage and tell the history of these communities.
Lopez says in the past, substantial research has come out of his course, which he adds focuses on issues often forgotten about in law schools. For Arizona News Connection, I'm Alex Gonzalez.
After a year of planning, the Alaska Federation of Natives Convention kicked off this morning. With that story more, here's today's edition of National Native News.
I'm Jill Freitas from KMBA in Anchorage, Alaska, filling in for Antonia Gonzalez. After a year of planning, the guests have gathered and the table has been set for another Alaska Federation of Natives convention, which will officially come to order at 9 this morning. The Kasigamute dancers from Bethel will welcome delegates today as they take their seats on the convention floor at the Dena'ina Center in downtown Anchorage. After opening ceremonies and speeches, the convention will hear from two keynote speakers this morning, Sophie Minnick, president and CEO of the Siri Native Corporation, and Ryan Reddington, champion of this year's Iditarod. This is the 57th annual AFN convention. This year's theme is Our Ways of Life, which will explore the subsistence lifestyles and communities across the state and how Alaska Natives are blending their culture and traditions to address today's challenges. Get Out the Native Vote efforts are underway this week in Anchorage as people from across the state gather downtown for the AFN convention. Michelle Spark is the director of Get Out the Native Vote, a statewide nonprofit, nonpartisan voter education group. She says one area they're focusing on is rural communities.
Rural village precincts with Native populations did not vote at all, either in August or in November. So we're here to make sure that the staffing happens, that there's less barriers to voting when it comes to an election day, and that our vote counts in the end.
Spark says they're gearing up for 2024. The theme for this year's annual Elders and Youth Conference that was held at the Dena'ina Center in downtown Anchorage, Alaska was Let It Be That We All Heal Each Other. In a room off to the side on the third floor was an energy healing room equipped with beds for meditation and gentle massage, as well as acupuncture sponsored by the South Central Foundation. One of the people in attendance was George Holly, Athabascan from Soldotna. He came to the Elders and Youth Conference to promote healing with multi-faith daily prayers at dawn.
About 4 years ago at Elders and Youth, a group of indigenous Baha'i friends from all over Alaska proposed that dawn belongs to all and that the earth turns and humbles itself before the sun each day, and we can do that too. And the Elders and Youth Conference was so open to it. We had a fire, and folks were attracted to be able to have that kind of expression again. And it's been going since, so this is its fifth year.
Another passion of Holly's is language revitalization. He says when it comes to healing, speaking your native language brings back cultural identity. Naomi Michelson is from Ketchikan. For 10 years, she worked for a domestic violence shelter, but found it hard to balance her personal life and her job. Still wanting to advocate for domestic violence victims, she took a different approach.
I took some time off and started a business called Kase Indigenous Foodways. And my hope and goal is to help people reconnect back to the land and to each other. I'm passionate about helping people, and including myself, with healing, and our families and our communities.
Michelson's approach on using food for healing goes hand in hand with this year's Alaska Federation of Natives Convention theme, Our Ways of Life. By exploring the subsistence lifestyles and communities in the state and how using culture and traditions can help address today's challenges. I'm Jill Freitas.
You are listening to a fall membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, October 19th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Eric Tegedoff, Roz Brown, and Alex Gonzalez. The producer is Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282 BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220 HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell.